You will be hearing more and more about General Assembly in the weeks and months ahead because it is coming very close to you. Something on the order of 5,000 Unitarian Universalists from all over the continent and even the world will converge on Portland from June 24th to 28th. One of the most moving GA traditions is the opening ceremonies, a combination of worship service and ingathering. The best part is the banner parade. People from almost every congregation come in carrying their congregation's banner to celebratory music and raucous applause. It is simply stunning to see the banners keep coming and coming and coming. It's a grand way to know that we are not alone, not at all. One thing that always used to bug me about the opening ceremonies, and there was one thing that used to bug me about the opening ceremonies, and then a few years ago it got turned on its ear in a delightful, painful, quintessentially Unitarian way. For many years, a member of a local Native American tribe was invited to offer a blessing. A very well-meant gesture acknowledging that the land we stand on once belonged to someone else. Yet, too often this moment felt affected, done not so much to make amends, but to take pride in our own enlightenment. Then something marvelous happened. For the GA in St. Louis, a representative from a local tribe could not be found. The native peoples of Missouri have been driven so thoroughly from their land that none remained. The search went wider and wider until finally a member of a tribe from Kansas City, more than 200 miles away, answered the request with a firm refusal. He was unwilling to drive 4 hours to speak for 5 minutes so that a group of mostly privileged white people might feel less guilty. He said quite directly, "Do your own work. We won't do it for you." What a hit to the gut. How wonderful to hear such plain truth. Yet what I love most about this story is that we told it on ourselves. Right there at the very beginning in that opening assembly, we were told exactly why there would be no Native American blessing. The moment expressed so beautifully our failings and our great strength. We can be self-satisfied and overweening, too carefully politically correct. Yet we are also willing, even actively seeking, to hear the truth and to learn and grow from the truths we hear. I don't know what will happen at the opening ceremonies in Portland. The land of Lewis and Clark seems a very apt place to acknowledge the price Native Americans have paid to the European expansion so many others have benefited from. However the moment is handled, it will be informed by a deeper understanding of our work as individuals and as an association of congregations. We must indeed do this work. We must do our own work. We must examine our hearts, see our privilege and our pain, and speak from our own experience, trying to understand the assumptions we operate from and how they affect others. Recognizing privilege is the first step, and that's plenty hard all by itself. I know that I could say yes to all but maybe one item on the checklist that David and I read earlier. As a person of European descent, called white in this land, my privilege is conferred upon me. Add to that an economically affluent background, and my privilege is secure. Yet for those of us who have it, white privilege is something very hard to see. We were generally born into it and did not seek the advantages it grants. We can often bristle at the suggestion that it automatically makes us consciously or unconsciously racist. Yet we cannot ignore the racial currents and dynamics in our society. People of European descent often look clueless, if not outright racist, because we miss what is so patently obvious to someone who is not part of the majority culture. People on the margins often can see, understand, and analyze a culture far more clearly than people at the center of it. It is challenging, even scary work, to examine that privilege and understand its effects. Scholar Peggy McIntosh, a white woman, calls white privilege, quote, an invisible package of unearned assets that I can count on cashing in each day, but about which I was meant to remain oblivious. White privilege is like an invisible, weightless knapsack of special provisions, maps, passports, code books, visas, closed tools, and blank checks. So first we have to unpack our own knapsack and work with one another to raise our consciousness as people of privilege. The we I speak of here is white people of privilege, a description that applies to many, although I know not all of us here today. Next, we need to do what we can to mitigate the exclusionary effects on so many others. Understanding how we participate in racist systems and institutions can be such profoundly difficult work, and it helps us, therefore, to do this work together. The point we often miss is that, and quoting McIntosh again, in proportion as our racial group is being made confident, comfortable, and oblivious, other groups are likely being made uncomfortable, and alienated. Whiteness protects us from many kinds of hostility, distress, and violence, which we are subtly trained to visit in turn upon people of color. It is painful for me to see the ways I have unwittingly participated in oppression simply by living with a privilege that just feels like living my life. I don't mean to hurt anyone. That is a very odd sentence on my page. Sorry. One way that we can do our work is to see how racism ultimately hurts all of us, keeps us distant from one another, keeps us cut off from what Tandeka calls the lifeblood of those who refuse to surrender their humanity. Yet, as I can only speak from my own experience, let me tell you a story of my own complicity and pain. I loved my 10 years as a teacher, in part because the school that I taught at was relatively diverse. About half the students were white, and the rest were a mix of minorities: Black, Hispanic, Asian, Arab, Pacific Islander. One year, an African American student enrolled in fifth grade about mid-year. His name was Sir Cameron, and his teacher could not bring herself to call him by his full name. She insisted on calling him simply Cameron. Sir Cameron was a bit rowdy, and in a team meeting, his teacher called him uppity. Now, I knew this was at best a very poor choice of words. I also knew that my fellow teacher was a good woman, not an overt racist. And I knew she was not being fair to this student, that it was a matter of race and racism. I suspected that Sir Cameron's parents had named him so that everyone, black or white, would have to call their son Sir. A statement of pride and resistance. My colleague was a good woman, and I knew she was wrong, and I didn't say a thing. Now, I made it a point to call Sir Cameron by name, and perhaps he even noticed and appreciated it. But my real work was not in reaching out to him. My real work was in speaking to my colleague, someone of my own background, race, and status. That might have helped Sir Cameron and future students far more. I didn't say a thing, and I regret it to this day. I suspect most of us who have grown up white in this culture have similar stories, times when we silently stood on the side of privilege, not knowing quite what to say, not wanting to give offense. It's hard for me to tell you this story. It is a painful memory, and I am still ashamed of it. Yet carrying such pain in silence helps no one. As Dr. King said, in the end, we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. Our task in the work of becoming an anti-oppressive, anti-racist society is to examine our own experience and privilege and find ways to be allies to the oppressed. That's what Pee Wee Reese was doing when he put his arm around Jackie Robinson's shoulder that day back in 1947. He was Robinson's teammate and ally, and I am sure Robinson appreciated it. Yet Reese's real audience was the white folks in that stadium and the teams. Reese was fully aware that it could be his family and his friends who were saying such horrible things. He hurt for his teammate, and he was ashamed for himself. It is from that place of compassion and pain that the work to counter oppression begins. It is so very challenging. I didn't like telling you that story of my silence and my complicity, but it's true. and I hope we all can learn from it. Now, it's not often that any of us will have an opportunity to make such a grand gesture of solidarity as Pee Wee Reese was able to. Yet it's not really the grand gestures that make up a life. It is a series of small moments that we speak or remain silent. Small gestures that add up. Small gestures that can take great courage. I was afraid to say anything to my fellow teacher, afraid she would get defensive, think that I was calling her a racist. I have rehearsed what I might have said ever since. I have tried ever since not to remain silent out of fear. And sometimes I actually even manage to say something. Rarely am I as graceful as I would like to be. Often it is awkward, but I remind myself that being awkward, feeling awkward, is not as painful as the silence has been. Tandaka tells us to look inward and soothe the pain, then turn back to the world in all its brokenness, pain, and rage, and learn to love anew. To know that the blood, the lifeblood of generations who refuse to surrender their humanity in an inhumane world still courses through our veins. In that place, out of love for the world, out of love for ourselves and one another, despair can be transformed into hope. The racial dynamics in our culture are very complicated. Sometimes we, and again I'm speaking, the we is we people of privilege, we want to look to people of color to help us find our way through the minefield. But people of color have their own work. Negotiating a world where racism and oppression exist but are not always overt enough to resist directly, and even when they seem incredibly overt, as they have in Ferguson and New York in recent months, are still hard to get a hold of and name and resist. They do not have to be our teachers. They don't want to have to explain racial politics or even why something might be offensive. And so they tell us to do our own work. In the wake of the deaths of unarmed black men at the hands of police, this work is all the more vital, and it has also shifted something in our culture. My ministerial colleagues who went to the protests in Ferguson reported that they were acutely aware that while they could stand in solidarity, bearing witness to the pain, rage, and sense of injustice of the African American community, that their voices should not be the first to be heard. Indeed, they spoke very little. They mostly listened and witnessed and spoke very little until they returned to their congregations. That is where their authority lay, where their work lay. That is where their experiences could be most useful. Their witness in Ferguson was a grand gesture of sorts, yet it felt less grand to them in the moment as they bore witness to much grander forces and deeper needs than they could address. We can only examine our own privilege wherever it lies and speak from our own experience. I encourage you to break the silence that comes of fear. I encourage you to speak gently and honestly of your experience. Gently and honestly to one another. For this is not work that we should attempt alone. It can only work if we stand together. Stand together on the side of love and not of privilege. So let us all take on this hard work together. Tenderly, honestly, and with small steps, doing each of us what we can, breaking the silence of our own pain, and the silence in which we fail to stand up as we wish we could, we wish we would, we wish we had. Acknowledging pain and fear, standing in witness, allowing ourselves as ever to let love guide us, so that our gestures, both grand and mundane, move us closer to bringing forth the world of peace and justice we so deeply yearn for. Let us stand together on the side of love. Amen, and blessed be.